Yeah. My name is Tim Knepper. I direct the Comparison Project. And the Comparison Project is, quote, an experimental effort in a philosophy of religion that is historically grounded and religiously diverse. For those of you who have been at a few events, apologies. I'm going to repeat myself. We mean what we say there in each and every phrase. Religiously diverse in that we consider expressions of religion from a diversity of cultures and historical periods. Historically grounded in that we're looking to actual religious expressions and not constructions of scholars. Philosophy of religion in that we do want to educate on religious diversity within and between religions. We do want to provide a site for interfaith dialogue involving great students and members of the community, but we also want to do philosophy of religion, some comparative work detecting similarities and differences, and some work in the way of explaining and seeing the meaning and significance of those patterns. And finally, it's an experimental effort, and we don't know if other people are really doing this, so we have no models, so we're going to trip and fall sometimes, and you're going to help us out and tell us what you're doing right and what we're doing wrong. Yes? Yes, thank you. We're generously funded by six different sources, some from within Drake, some from without Drake. I thank them all. The Humanities Center here at Drake, the Principal Financial Group Center for Global Citizenship, the Medbury Fund, the Des Moines Area Religious Council, Cultivating Compassion, the Richard Denning Foundation, and Humanities Iowa, the Iowa branch of the NEH. And I must read a disclaimer here. Of course, you know, the opinions expressed in today's program do not necessarily reflect those of these supporters. A few logistical matters before I introduce tonight's speaker. What are they? First, this thing I'm holding in my hand, this is a sign-up for the event. I can only see things in front of me or things far away. I'll hold the things in front of me far away. Humanities Iowa requires us to take attendance. I'm going to send this around. You only really need to give us your name, but if you want to be on the email list for the Comparison Project or for Humanities Iowa, there's a place to designate that and provide your email address. I'll start this now. Secondly, we have some brochures in the back for the Comparison Project and for Humanities Iowa. Humanities Iowa also invites evaluations of our program, and there's some evaluation forms back there. If you care to do so, that would be very much appreciated. If you want more information about the Comparison Project, there are the brochures, but you can also find us on the web. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And the woman who makes all that possible, I thank my faithful research assistant, my competent, very competent research assistant, Nora Sullivan. What else do we have? I will forget if I don't look. Okay. Now for an introduction for a speaker. When my colleagues and I first met to discuss the theme and speakers for our first year programming for the Comparison Project, we didn't agree on a whole lot, but we did agree both that we wanted the program to give voice to Native American religious traditions, and that we wanted Michael Lee and Peasant Tubby to be that voice. Sure, there was the locality factor. Professor Peasant Tubby teaches just down the road, that is I-80 in Iowa City at the University of Iowa, where she is associate professor in the Religious Studies Department and for the American Indian Native Studies program. And this was important to us in the program, given that we also wanted to showcase some local Iowa talent for our first year. But far more important was the quality and focus of Professor Peasant Tubby's research. She's the author of numerous works that address Native American religious movements that arise in response to colonization, most notably her 2005 book, Choctaw Woman in a Chaotic World, which examines how contact experiences with the French and British led to significant changes in Choctaw women's lives, in which one reviewer lauded as a, quote, example of sterling scholarship and significant contribution to the scholarly literature on ethnicity and gender. Even more pertinent for our program was Professor Peasant Tubby's work on recent Native American responses to the massacre at Wounded Knee, most importantly her essay, ritual of resistance and recovery, and From Vision to Violence, the Wounded Knee Massacre. Professor Pezzatelli's talk tonight will consider some of this research, examining how several Native American groups have responded to the effects of colonization by drawing on traditional dances to heal individuals and communities. In particular, she will focus on the Lakota Ghost Dance and the Cherokee Booger Dances as ritual means for countering despair and suffering and instilling hope and harmony. Please join me in welcoming Professor Pezzatelli.
Thank you, and thank you for Professor Knepper and the Department of Religious Studies and Philosophy for inviting me to be part of this comparative lecture series. I'm really pleased to be able to provide a Native American perspective, one anyway, on this the subject of suffering. When I was writing this paper, I didn't give it a lot of and when I was first asked to give a paper, I thought, I don't really work in this area. I don't know that I have anything to offer. And then I sat and thought about it for a little bit, and I thought, well, everything I write about is about suffering. Of course I can do this. I also want to thank all of you for coming out tonight. I'm Choctaw from Oklahoma, and we have a saying in Oklahoma that every day is a good day. It doesn't matter if it's windy, rainy, cold, wet. If you're alive and kicking, it's a good day. So I'm glad you came out, and I hope you're having a good day. I want to start out first by asking you to do something. Imagine for a moment that the year is 1790, and you are sitting in a dark lodge filled with people sitting and standing around the perimeter. Perhaps the smell of smoke from the fire is stinging your eyes and impeding your vision. You hear people singing and drums beating, and everyone around you appears serious and focused. Okay, we'll try this one. All of a sudden, a bunch of odd-looking men wearing grotesque masks made from gourds and ragged clothes burst into the lodge and begin dancing about, twisting and contorting their bodies in such unusual ways that you wonder if they are deranged. Some of the masked men make obscene gestures towards the women. Others chase the women, who run from them. And to your horror, everyone in the lodge is laughing at the spectacle. Okay, to the uninitiated, such a scene would probably draw exclamations of disgust and perhaps outrage that people would find their sexual antics towards women humorous. For the Cherokee people, however, the noisy, frightening scene is cathartic. What the Cherokees are witnessing is a caricature of European men. Take a close look at this mask. You'll see that the face is bearded. This is one hint that it's a European, because most full-blood native men can't grow facial hair. If they do, it's very thin. So they always put beards on them. You'll also notice that there's hair around the nose. That's to represent male sexual organs. I'll show a couple of more just to give you an idea here of what they look like. These masked men are called boogers, and they symbolize the violence that white males brought to Cherokee country. Like many Native American women, Cherokee females became the targets of Spanish, French, and English explorers and soldiers who, having traveled for weeks and even months across dangerous seas and lands without wives, turned to Native American women to satisfy their desires. Some took Cherokee women to work as servants, including as servants of the bedroom. Others brutally raped Cherokee women and then sold them as slaves to other Europeans. All the women suffered unimaginable insult to their bodies and their psyches. But the women did not suffer alone. The men, unable to protect them from the sexual aggressions of European males, seethed with anger and shame and often sought revenge. The Cherokees suffered a deep and painful injury to their social well-being. They faced a crime that had been literally unheard of in their communities before the arrival of Europeans. To deal with the atrocities, the Cherokee turned to their traditional stories and practices. Based on their story about the origin of disease, The Cherokee could understand what was happening to them as a community-wide illness. Sickness can arise when people violate social sanctions or when social oppositions arise between humans and supernatural forces. For the Cherokee, their ultimate concern was arguably fostering harmony, especially among themselves, but also with those whom they considered friends and allies, including those of the spirit world. Rape of women violated social sanctions. It disrupted harmonious relations. To restore harmony among the women and the community as a whole, the Cherokee turned to the booger dance. According to Cherokee tradition, the dance originated in the long ago at a time when a monster known as Stone Coat threatened the well-being of human beings. He loved to eat people. One day, a hunter who had climbed to the top of a high ridge saw an old man moving towards the Cherokee's hunting camp. The old man's behavior frightened the hunter, so he hurried back to the camp to tell the others about him. After hearing the description of the old man, the medicine man said that he was a cannibal monster who would kill and eat them all. He told everyone that the only way to destroy the monster was to have 7 menstruating women stand in his path, and as the monster encountered each one in turn, he would become weaker and weaker, and by the time he reached the last woman, he would collapse. Everything happened just as the medicine man said it would. When Stone Coat fell to the ground, hunters quickly pinned him to the ground with a stake and surrounded him with fire, which burned towards him. As the flames started to lick at Stone Coat, he began to talk. He told the Cherokee about all the medicines they could use to cure all kinds of sicknesses. He also told them of his vision of the coming of white and black people and strange Native Americans from the East. Just before Stone Coat breathed his last breath, he gave the Cherokee the booger dance as a means for counteracting the social and physical contamination that enemies or aliens, in this case, since we're talking about Europeans who hadn't been invited yet, maybe I should say illegal or undocumented aliens, might be among them. I'm just going to take that away. Boogers with masks characterizing Native Americans and even dangerous animals danced and mimicked those who brought disharmony among them. So it wasn't just about Europeans. What Stone Coat was teaching them was how to protect themselves from anyone who brought disharmony or illness. So in this case, this is actually a Native American woman, probably Iroquoian or somewhere from the East, and maybe she's bringing some kind of disease, smallpox or something with her, but it's to protect them from her. Another example is this one on the left is wearing a hornet's nest. And the Cherokee have stories where, for example, if children misbehave, hornets come and sting them. And so they learn that if they don't want to get stung by the hornets, they better behave. So they're using all kinds of masks. They use them to ridicule those who brought misfortune. What they did was they took away the power to threaten people. Instead, they became something to be laughed at, humiliated, and ostracized. So it made sense to the Cherokee to use booger masks and booger dances to counteract the malignant acts of Europeans. When booger dancers caricatured European males, they were in fact rendering them impotent. European males became awkward, lewd, and weak intruders controlled by their sexual organs. As Lee Irwin explains, the negative use of power and knowledge by European males is transformed through the sacred medium of dance into a positive healing practice. Their destructive behavior was subdued by character and dance and transformed into traditional patterns of knowledge that are both potent and healing. The booger dance also worked because it called to mind the power of women who destroyed Stone Coat when he threatened the entire community. In addition, as Irwin noted, the purpose of healing ceremonies is to restore balance and equilibrium. For the Cherokee, although oppositions exist in the world, those oppositions can work to balance each other out. So although Stone Coat was a life taker, someone who ate people, In his death throes, he was also a life giver, one who provided knowledge about healing and the future. Thus, the act of rape that caused social disharmony was countered by the booger dance, which brought the community together in a healing ceremony that worked by creating laughter. And of course, we all know laughter has a positive effect on us, right? Sexual aggression was just one of many factors Cherokees and other Native Americans had to cope with as part of the contact experience. They perhaps faced no greater threat to their well-being and way of life than the introduction of private property and wealth. Think about that. They entered an economic system that they did not fully understand, nor at the time could they imagine in their wildest dreams the enormous changes that would result from their participation in the system. Now, all of you are familiar with the story. Native Americans all across the continent lost enormous amounts of land, populations of game animals declined rapidly, and alcohol abuse became a huge problem. Everywhere in North America, Native peoples turned to dance to help restore the world as they once knew it. Among the Cherokee, just before the War of 1812, they recognized that they were in a crisis state. People began experiencing visions in 1811 and early 1812, in which they learned why the Cherokee were suffering so much. The first report came from three people, and this is not unusual among the Cherokee. They often had group visions. The three people who were traveling together near Rocky Mountain in Georgia. Okay. According to one of them, Charlie, a messenger appeared to the three of them and told them that the provider, the one above, the creator, was angry with them for letting white people take over their land and for adopting the customs of white people. The messenger explained that that was why the game animals were disappearing. He also told them that if they returned to their old ways and began to hold feasts and dances again, then the game would return and the mother of the nation, or Mother Earth or Earth Mother, would once again provide for them. Although the Cherokees had never fully ceased dancing, they had curtailed their ceremonies. But after hearing about the vision, many of them started doing the ceremonies again, in fact, with great enthusiasm, encouraging others to join them. And in another vision, a messenger came to a father who was taking care of his sick children and told him that the provider was unhappy that the Cherokee had sold so much land to white people and that they were no longer giving thanks for the bounty of the land. In other words, they were no longer holding dances in the provider's honor before partaking of the first corn of the harvest season. It's common knowledge in the southeastern United States that Native peoples, even if they were starving, would never take a bite of corn, of the first corn or the first potato or whatever, unless they had done the ceremonies for it. In both these visions, the Cherokee learned that they were suffering because they failed to show proper thanks to the provider by dancing. They knew people were no longer carrying out the ceremonies as they once had. Some of the ceremonies had shortened to 1 or 2 days, and others were no longer being practiced. And people were being disrespectful by drinking alcohol at the ceremonies. The Cherokee knew that the dances expressed Cherokee values, such as redistribution of food, the importance of contributions by men and women, and respect for other beings of the world, both physical and supernatural. By not dancing, their children were not learning proper behavior towards other Cherokee and towards the spirits. They were suffering because of their own failures, and only by reviving the dances could they restore the world as they once knew it. However, in the late 1830s, the Cherokee were marched to Indian Territory, what is now Oklahoma, and their dances practically disappeared. It would not be until the 1890s when Redbird Smith and his brothers started up the new stomp grounds and revived the dances again. In that interim, those were very hard times for the Cherokee. They see the return of the stomp dance as the light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, the beginning of better times. The Cherokee weren't the only ones who believed that they could change the course of events if they danced. All across the North American continent, prophets appeared who warned people that they needed to return to the old ways, to do as the Creator said. If they wanted to see better times, they needed to dance, and dance they did. However, white settlers often didn't appreciate the dancing. They saw dancing as the primitive antics of superstitious peoples. When the Lakota people in Dakota Territory began ghost dancing in the spring of 1890, they did so in hopes of bringing back the way of life they had known before they were confined to reservations. Indian agents and military officers repeatedly warned the ghost dancers to stop dancing, but they refused to do so. Even when officers arrested dancers and local ranchers harassed them, they still danced. They danced for days at a time until one cold December day in 1890, when more than 500 United States soldiers and scouts rounded up a group of ghost dancers and massacred close to 300 unarmed men, women, and children. For 30 minutes, they chased the Lakota down ravines and across the land for nearly 3 miles. Before the massacre, the Lakota had good reason to believe that their lives were in danger. In fact, some of the dancers were so afraid of what Indian agents, Indian police, and the U.S. military might do to them if they kept dancing, that they fled to the Badlands. But once again, they did not stop dancing. To understand why they continued dancing, even under the threat of arrest or worse, we first have to understand what life was like for them in 1889 when they first heard of the dance. Prior to the arrival of white settlers, soldiers, and missionaries, the Lakota occupied a territory that stretched from Minnesota all the way to the Colorado Rockies. For at least 2,000 years, they had been synchronizing their movements across the Great Plains with the movement of the sun through certain constellations in the sky and with the migration of bison. By observing the night skies, they knew where they were supposed to be on the land, when they should be there, and what they should be doing. Life made sense. Then the Wasichus came. At first, the whites were curiosities, then nuisances, as missionaries and agents of the government tried to convert them into Christian farmers. Then settlers started appearing in greater and greater numbers, either wanting to cross Lakota lands to reach the Pacific Northwest or to settle down in Dakota Territory as ranchers. The U.S. government urged the Lakota to discuss treaties with them. At first, the treaties were about friendship and about passage across the plains. Then in 1868, everything changed. The second Fort Laramie Treaty established the Great Sioux Reservation, which you can see right there in South Dakota. The beginning of the end of a way of life for the Lakota. Lakota people found themselves confined to reservations, or what their holy man Black Elk called little islands that were always becoming smaller and smaller. Gold had been discovered. Railroad tracks were laid across the land, and settlers came in droves. Whites began killing bison by the hundreds, knowing that the Lakota depended upon them for every aspect of their economy, from housing to clothing to food. Here you can see a huge pile of buffalo hides from 1868, 40,000 buffalo hides that were left probably to be shipped out. Here's an even larger pile of bison bones. Some of the settlers or people passing through wanted the horns or skins. The skins could be used to make hats or bags. They were wanted in the eastern part of the United States and in Europe, and they also ground the horns and used them. But other than that, they left the carcasses, literally left carcasses of thousands and thousands of bison just rotting on the plains. I do want to mention that the Lakota played a part in this because they did participate in the bison trade economy, but when they saw what was happening, they felt helpless to stop what was going on. By then, really, it was too late. In less than a decade, approximately 40 million bison were killed. 40 million. By 1900, only 26 bison remained in the United States. And those were in Yellowstone National Park, where they were protected, and they're part of that herd today, or they're the ancestors of the herds today. The Lakota no longer knew what to do. Whereas before they knew what the great mysterious expected of them, now they floundered in doubt and misery. Some tried to follow the instructions of the Indian agents and missionaries. They planted crops, they raised cattle, but things never seemed to go their way. In 1888, black leg disease spread among the cattle. The next year, the U.S. government called for more treaty negotiations. The Lakota were gone so long at the negotiations that they lost a good part of their crops. The following year, they lost their crops again, but this time to drought. During this time of crisis, when they most needed it, the federal government decided to drastically reduce the amount of rations appropriated to the Lakota in violation of the treaty agreement signed the previous year. The Lakota, starving and disillusioned, must have felt that the Creator was punishing them because they were no longer performing their ceremonial duties. They wanted to, but Indian agents had banned their most important ceremony, the Sun Dance, since the early 1870s. By 1883, the Department of Interior had created their rules for Indian offenses that stipulated severe punishments for those Lakota found violating the bans. The inability to carry out their ceremonies was traumatic for the Lakota. They believed the Creator spoke to them through constellations in the sky, letting them know when they should do certain ceremonies and when they should do them. In other words, as the sun passed through these constellations you see up there, the Lakota mirrored what they were doing, beginning with their breaking their winter camps and starting to move towards the Black Hills, doing certain ceremonies across the Black Hills, around the Black Hills, until they ended up at what's known today as Devil's Tower. But now, the Lakota could not follow the Creator's instructions because they were confined to those shrinking little islands. Despair and disillusionment was everywhere as sickness and death surrounded them. Epidemics of influenza, measles, and whooping cough raced through their communities in 1889 and 1890. Hungry and sick, they were unable to endure the winter cold without the clothes the government had promised but never delivered. Many died. So imagine how excited the Lakota felt in 1889 when they first heard about a prophet out west who spoke of a medicine dance that could bring better times for Native Americans. In the fall of that year, the Lakota sent a delegation from Rosebud, Cheyenne River, and Pine Ridge agencies to Nevada to learn more about the Paiute prophet Wovoka. When the delegation returned home in March 1890, they brought good news. The Creator had spoken to Wovoka, telling him that he would send a major catastrophe to destroy all whites in the spring of 1891. There was more good news. The spirits of their deceased relatives and herds of bison and horses would return to repopulate the earth. The sick would be healed, and diseases would no longer ravish their communities. However, in order to bring about all these changes, the Creator said they must dance. And dance they did. They danced for days at a time, some until they were so exhausted they fell to the ground. Many outsiders believe that the Lakota danced so vigorously and in the face of threats from soldiers because they were desperate. Yes, the Lakota were in desperate conditions, but to assume that they danced out of desperation is to misunderstand Lakota conceptions of the principles of life and healing. The ghost dance, or more accurately, the spirit dance, was a medicine dance, a powerful, community-centered, world renewal ceremony, much like the sun dance. To the Lakota, dance had the power to draw people together, to unite them in common prayer and purpose. Dance had the power to bring them visions, visions of how to heal themselves and to restore the world as it should be. Unfortunately, observers of the time and many scholars saw what they wanted to see: desperate people taking desperate measures. Their descriptions of the dances border on the fantastic. One white observer painted a picture of what I can only describe as demonic possession. He described dancers, and I'm quoting him, "in their frenzy rushed against our horses and were thrown headlong to the ground," end quote. He continued by saying they all danced until they, quote, "became so exhausted as to be able only to writhe on the ground, screaming and moaning all the time," end quote. Of course, the descriptions were no doubt meant to horrify and to titillate at the same time. And you see it constantly in the descriptions. One teacher at Standing Rock described dancers as screaming, dancing, and wildly waving their arms. Another woman, described only as Mrs. Parker, described the ghost dancers' prayers and songs as, quote, "the most fearful, heart-piercing wails I ever heard, crying, moaning, groaning, and shrieking," end quote. It does sound scary. And if you didn't know they were talking about the ghost dance, you would probably think they were describing a haunted house on Halloween night. At least that's what I see. Even the way they describe their outfits sounds like ghosts and goblins. One scout described the dancers as dressed in their devilish toggery. And when you look at this artist's rendition of the ghost dance, you can see that he's playing right into their descriptions. The hair on this one is flying upward. You see exaggerated motion, both feet off the ground. This person laying on the ground, legs and arms flailing every which way. This is supposed to be a ceremony. This is supposed to be a dance of healing. But this is the image that everyone was given. So what I want to do is to describe the ghost dance to you from a sympathetic perspective that takes into consideration Lakota religious beliefs and societal values. Let me begin first with this idea among Lakota that their ceremonies take place in accordance with natural patterns of nature that last from 4 to 7 days. Four symbolizes the four directions, the four winds, and the four stages of life. So in accordance with the natural patterns, the ghost dance typically lasted 4 nights. Okay. In preparation for such a lengthy ceremony, the ghost dancers brought their teepees and set them up all around the dance ground. They placed a tree in the center of the ground, symbolizing the connection between Makah, the earth, and Skah, the sky, thus creating a cosmic whole. Such an important ceremony required the dancers to purify themselves in sweat lodges and to mark themselves with the symbols of the sacred, including the sun, moon, morning star, and the eagle. All of them created the symbols using the sacred color red, among others. Some wore sacred eagle feathers in their hair. When the time came to dance, the dancers arranged themselves in a circle around the center tree, clasping their hands in unity. Now compare this painting with the one you just saw. Here you see their faces are not contorted at all. In fact, they look meditative, at least they do to me. You'll notice that you can tell by the way their arms and legs are placed that they are moving slowly, and that's how the dance began. They began slowly moving to the left in a sunwise direction. Here's another slide. This is actually a slide of an Arapaho ghost dance, but it was very similar. And again, you see that calm concentration of the dancers. They're all paying attention as they slowly began dancing. Just as the Lakota journey across the land, mirroring the sun's movement through the constellations in order to renew the world each year, the dancers also moved in a circular pattern to renew the world, to bring an end to the pain wrought by whites, and to restore the Lakota world as they once knew it. This is just a slide of the dance. Again, you can see that those wild, exaggerated motions aren't there. As the Lakota danced, they sang songs to Tunkashala, or grandfather, describing what will happen. Someone cometh to tell news. There shall be a buffalo chase. There shall be a buffalo chase. Make arrows. Make arrows. In other words, they're singing about the bison coming back out of the earth. For the Lakota and other Native Americans, words don't just describe the world around them. Words sung in the proper ritual fashion has the power to shape the world. The Lakota believed that the bison had returned to the womb of Makah, the earth mother, and through song and dance, they were calling the bison to return to the surface of the earth as they had once before in the long ago. Now, the Lakota had lost a lot of relatives to war, disease, and hunger, and they longed to see their relatives again, even if only in the spirit world. For the Lakota, it seemed as though those spirits were no longer around. So they sang, calling for them. The people are coming home. The people are coming home, said my father, said my father, said my father. The time cometh. I shall see him. The time cometh. I shall see him, said thy mother, said thy mother. Some of the dancers following the actions of Ion, that which existed when nothing else did, back at the beginning of time, cut themselves. Their blood flowed just as Ion's blood flowed when he cut himself, reinforcing the idea that power comes from sacrifice, from giving of oneself for the benefit of community. Cutting themselves was also a way of showing grief for the loss of land, bison, and relatives. That act of sacrifice had deep symbolic meaning for the Lakota. It was not an act of desperation by deranged people, as some have depicted them. Yes, they were crying or weeping, but not groaning or screaming or shrieking. Lakota cried for specific purposes. For example, when a Lakota goes on the hill to seek a vision, he or she cries. Crying is a ritual way of making oneself pitiful to Tunkashala. Lakota recognize that all they have comes from Tunkashala. They weep to express deeply felt humility so that the spirits will come to them in a vision. They also wail over the loss of loved ones. In the ghost dance, in which they prayed to Tunkashala for better times and for the return of the spirits of their deceased relatives, they also wept in humility and in grief. As the dance progressed, the dancers began to move faster and faster and faster. This is another artist's rendition of it. This one's a wood engraving. Here you can see the motion again, that they're moving very quickly here. You can see that they do raise their legs in step. Their arms are up, but they're not flailing. They're not swinging them around. They're holding up feathers or staffs. Some of them are looking upwards and praying to the Creator. But again, it's not that erratic, grotesque image that was created. And let me just let you compare the two. Again, you can see the first artist's rendition really making them look like demons or something. I'll put it back to the original one. It's the rhythmic movement, the speed of the dancing, all push their bodies to their limits by aiding them in achieving trance-like states, a state in which they became open to receiving the sacred, of having a vision. A vision for the Lakota is contact with powerful spirit beings who guide them and protect them. The interaction takes place at a spirit level. The Lakota believe that a person has four souls. One of those souls, the Naji, sometimes described as the shadow, ghost, or spirit of the person, is the spirit that can move between this world and the spirit world. During the ghost dance, some of the people reached a state where their Naji traveled to the spirit world. When their Naji returned, the dancers spoke of seeing their relatives, of being in a beautiful land where everyone is happy and where they experienced a wonderful reunion with their friends and relatives who had died at some previous time. The ghost dance, like the vision quest, required great physical endurance. The Lakota have a long history of going through ceremonies that require humility, fasting and thirsting, and standing or dancing that prepare them physically and mentally to enter a state in which they are able to communicate with the spirit world. When a ghost dancer entered that state, in other words, when his or her Naji left her body, the person fell to the ground, appearing unconscious. He or she was not writhing about wildly, as some have suggested. The ghost dance made sense to the Lakota. It fit in with their understanding of the way in which one prayed to the great mysterious when one sought guidance, aid, or power. The dance itself was a way to strengthen the community. Through ritual sacrifice of the flesh, through strenuous dance, through expressions of humility, the dancers gave hope to each other. They let each other know that they were willing to do whatever was necessary to help their community. Like in the Sun Dance, the people saw the ghost dancers engaging in acts of bravery and fortitude, and that gave them strength. Yes, they were weeping and dancing rapidly, and some fell to the ground in a trance-like state, but they were not deranged people possessed by demons, acting out of desperation, as depicted by local whites. Unfortunately, white ranchers, Indian agents, military officers, and reporters painted a false picture of militant Sioux war dancing as they prepared to attack whites. The ghost dancers never had a chance to help the Lakota people recover from the shock of colonization and the reservation system. The massacre of nearly 300 ghost dancers ended the public practice of the ghost dance as frightened dancers fled to agencies for protection and others stopped dancing for fear of further attacks. However, the ghost dance did not cease to exist after the massacre, as many scholars have stated. But it did go underground, it did undergo changes, and very few danced as the threat of imprisonment or punishment for practicing ceremonies became greater and greater. However, the ghost dance did return to the public eye in 1973. That year, American Indian activists occupied Wounded Knee, the location of the massacre that took place 83 years earlier. The occupiers were protesting U.S. policies, including the termination and relocation programs of the 1950s, the mishandling of Native American affairs by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the suppression of Native American self-determination, and the recent heavy-handed tactics of Oglala Tribal Chairman Dick Wilson. This small group of protesters was soon surrounded by units of the South Dakota National Guard, U.S. Marshal Services deputies, FBI agents, BIA police, tribal police, and border patrolmen. Wow. Sometimes gunfire erupted. Outnumbered and outgunned, the occupiers refused to surrender to authorities. Hungry and tired, the occupiers, who had few resources, turned to the ghost dance for strength and guidance. They found some burlap and some curtains and made ghost dance shirts out of them. They painted ghost dance symbols on the shirts, just as the first ghost dancers had 83 years earlier. Leonard Crow Dog led 40 men and women in 4 days of ghost dancing in the gully where the massacre had occurred. Russell Means reminded the occupiers that the 1890 ghost dancers had suffered from cold and hunger just as they now suffered. The ghost dance renewed their spirits. Eventually, they negotiated the end of the occupation. Symbolically, the dancers reversed the events of 1890 because they walked out of Wounded Knee alive. By facing the might of the American government with their demands and occupying Wounded Knee for 71 days, and more importantly, walking out of there alive, the activists helped the Lakota as well as all Native Americans to heal from the devastation of the 1890 massacre at Wounded Knee. Wounded Knee became a place of survival and not just of death. For Native Americans, colonization has not ended, nor have Native people fully recovered from the devastating U.S. policies or missionary agendas of the 19th and 20th centuries. In fact, as George Tinker, an Osage theologian, has pointed out, Native Americans have so internalized the messages of centuries of colonialism that, quote, we have become complicit in our own oppression, end quote. In his book, Missionary Conquest, Tinker states that, quote, today, an Indian pastor is more likely than a white missionary to criticize the paganism of traditional spirituality, end quote. Yet, arguably, dance has done much to overcome that internal colonialism after nearly half a century of condemning those Native American Protestants who participated in powwows. Powwow dancing started becoming an acceptable socio-cultural activity among church members in the 1970s. Although powwow dancing can be traced back to the mid-18th century, the first large intertribal powwow took place in 1926 at a major colonial institution, Haskell Indian School in Kansas. The powwow became a way for Native Americans from diverse cultural backgrounds, forced together in an alien boarding school setting, to find common means for expressing their Native identities and cultural practices. This was not an insignificant turn of events. As I mentioned earlier, many dances associated with major ceremonies had been banned by the Department of Interior in the 1890s through the early 1930s. Instead of tribal communities coming together to carry out traditional ceremonial dances, a few Native Americans, many of them Lakota, found themselves dancing to entertain whites. The irony here is that although it was illegal for the Lakota to hold ceremonial dances, they could legally dance as entertainment for white audiences. At one time, there were more than 50 different dance groups touring the United States, Canada, and Europe. Many were recruited by William F. Buffalo Bill Cody and Gordon W. Pawnee Bill Lilly to dance in their Wild West shows. Although the dances originated from traditional dances, Buffalo Bill and Pawnee Bill demanded that Native American dancers spice up their dances to entertain the audiences. Of course, you get that wild flailing that you see here and all the whoops and stuff that we sometimes associate with Native Americans. Of course, the dances and dancers were meant to excite the crowd by reminding them of their claim to greatness as the ones chosen to tame the West, including the wild Indians. Some of those dances later morphed into powwow dances, such as the fancy dance. However, despite the powwow's roots in reservation era and post-reservation colonialism, the powwow became a means for Native American healing. For reservation Native Americans, the local community powwows embody and express traditional religious beliefs and practices. The same is true for urban contest powwows, although the spiritual aspects are probably not so apparent to audience who are not informed about powwows. Powwow dances transmit intertribal and tribal histories, beliefs, and customs, which in turn connect Native Americans to their ancestors and to the sacred. I like the way Tara Browner talks about her experiences with talking to Powwow peoples. She said she often heard them say or speak about ancestors being present at powwows and dancing along with them, joining worlds with a drumbeat sounding simultaneously at both. For Lakota and many Native Americans, the material world is not the real world. It's the shadow of the spirit world, and it's the spirit world that's the real world. To say the drumbeat is beating simultaneously in both is a very powerful statement. Powwows heal because they provide a culturally significant way of identifying as Native American. For centuries, missionaries and teachers had tried to Americanize Native Americans, cutting off their hair, forbidding the speaking of their language, and taking away their traditional clothing. Native American children were taught to be ashamed of their traditional ways. Powwow dances changed all that, at least for powwow dancers. For example, generations of Native Americans had been taught by missionaries and teachers that women were subordinate to men, contrary to traditional complementary roles found in Native American societies. The cost of family and community harmony over generations has been enormous. The powwow is one way in which Native Americans have resisted that message. For example, the powwow reminds everyone of the importance of women by conferring the title of powwow princess upon young women and girls who compete for that honor. To be a powwow princess is to be recognized as someone who exemplifies the best of what it means to be part of the powwow community and a tribal community. Those girls or women who earn the title demonstrate traditional talent, sometimes through song or dance or maybe storytelling. The powwow princess is held to a high standard, serving as an example to young girls. She is someone who is skilled at public speaking and who conveys traditional values to those around her. Powwow princesses are always recognized at powwows, and as you can see in this grand entry, they are a prominent part of the procession that starts the beginning of the powwow. Powwows are also about healing. The Ojibwa, or Anishinaabe, say that the jingle dancer constitutes a prayer for healing. These are jingle dancers. You can see the cones on their dress that jingle as they dance, a very rhythmic sound. Thus, every time those jingle dancers dance, those who know the origin of the jingle dress know that prayers are being made. The powwow instills pride in Native Americans. As Robert Desjarlais describes it, whether we are dancers or singers or spectators, when the powwow ends, we walk away from it with a profound sense of well-being. We feel good about who we are and where we come from. So whether we are talking about the historical and generational traumas resulting from U.S. policies towards Native Americans or contemporary socioeconomic problems in Indian country today, dance is one way Native Americans heal themselves. Dance was and continues to be a way for individuals and entire communities to cleanse themselves of the effects of colonization and to transform the way they see the world, even if only temporarily. Through dance, Native Americans maintain their connection to the spirit world, to their ancestors, to the land, and to their stories. Thank you. Yes.
Powwow dances, are they tribe specific or are they amalgamation of tradition?
That's the $50 question. You can tell in some instances what tribe the person belongs to by their outfit, but there's a lot of borrowing. Most people will refer to them as intertribal. Many of the outfits have origins in particular communities, but again, the jingle dance might have originated with the Ojibwe, but I've seen Navajo from New Mexico wearing jingle dresses. Down in Oklahoma, I've seen jingle dresses. So, yeah. I don't know if I've answered your question, but there is some specific...
I was just wondering how strong an individual tribe's tradition comes through. I mean, if it was all displaced and lost.
It comes through because powwow dancers know the origin of these dances. They know the history. And there is a lot of religious aspects to the dance, and they know what it is. Powwows open with prayer. The grounds are blessed before the powwow begins, and people who are part of the powwow community know all of this, and they are very respectful towards the powwow. That's not to say you won't see some Native peoples being disrespectful, but I would argue that they're not familiar with the powwow dance. They don't understand what it's about. But each community, you go to Crow Fair, for instance, up in Montana, and it's very much a Crow experience. Go to Lakota, one of the Lakota reservations, Pine Ridge. It's very much a Lakota experience, although you will see other Native Americans there. Yeah. Bear's Lodge, I believe. I'm trying to remember. The Lakota word. I can't think of it at the moment, but it originates out of a story of. I don't want to mix it up with the Kiowa one. There's several tribes that see Devil's Tower as sacred and powerful, and they have similar stories. And either it's one child or two sisters, or it's several girls, like seven girls, who are sometimes they're running from a brother who turns into a bear and chases them. And when they get on this outcropping, it rises up and they become like the seven girls become the Pleiades up in the sky. But they all call it something like Bear's Lodge, whatever their term is for it. Very different to call it Devil's Tower. It takes on a whole different meaning when you realize that was a place where children were saved.
Do you know how the second came about then?
You know, I used to, but I don't remember anymore. I don't remember that history. No, I don't remember. Sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
Thank you. Say what?
That all Indians can now dance any kind of dance.
Yes. There have been several acts. The most recent, I guess, and I might get my date wrong. I think it was 1978. It could have been 1975, the American Indian Religious Freedom Act. The irony is the First Amendment should have protected them to begin with as citizens of the United States. But it didn't. An act had to be passed by Congress to protect their religious rights. And even that didn't protect those rights because you have to fund any act to carry out, to ensure that those laws are carried out or people are somehow punished for violating those. It's supposed to protect them. Right now I would say yes, they can dance. I don't know of an instance where they're prevented by law. Now, they might be prevented by, say, they're part of a particular Christian denomination that might frown on dancing, then they wouldn't be able to dance in that case. But it wouldn't be the government, state government or federal government preventing it. Oh, I wish. Maybe they will come up with one. The Cherokee are actually doing a lot with regard to the environment. They have their own organized group looking at issues of pollution of the Illinois River, of the air, and things like that. And they're trying to bring back traditional, they have a whole seed program to bring back traditional plants and things. They may, who knows? That would be great, wouldn't it? If I can remember the names of them, which I don't guarantee I can, let me see if I can go backwards here. Let me see if I can remember some of them. This one they call the pipe. It's actually two constellations, but they do their pipe ceremony. That's the first one the sun goes through. This is a... Right, yeah. When the sun is going through the pipe, I can't remember what they call it. Then they know to break their winter camps and start moving, and then they start doing prayers, welcoming back the rains, the plants, the animals. Then, as the sun moves into the next constellation, they move towards Harney Peak, which is I believe their highest peak. And then they start, I think that's where they start collecting the tobacco for their pipes, so they might have done that with the first one. I don't remember the order. I do remember the end. The last one is Devil's Tower, where they traditionally did the sun dance. Not with the sun dance, no. The sun dance, people who made vows participated in the dance, and the sun dance is different from the ghost dance. The sun dance is always held in summer. Used to be held on June 21st. It still is for most, the longest day of the year. They're not able to do it at Devil's Tower or near Devil's Tower anymore because that's a national park now. And because it's the longest day of the year, that's also when rock climbers want to climb it. They have that's the longest day. They can spend the most time on it. It's caused a lot of conflict. The National Park Service did try to impose a voluntary ban asking... Around that time, yes, the longest day of the year, yes, because they're facing the sun while they dance. That's a whole other story. But with the sun dance, people make a vow. You don't enter the sun dance lightly because it's a very trying ordeal. Okay, they're piercing their pectoral muscles typically. That's one way of doing it. And they're attached to a pole and they dance facing the sun all day long. And as they dance, eventually the cords will tear through their muscle, through their skin. I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but okay. Okay. It could be almost anything. Say someone is sick. Maybe your child is sick or your parent is sick. You might make a vow to Tunkashala that if the person recovers, if the person is healed, that you will do the sun dance. Women can also... sacrifice. They don't dance, they don't pierce, but they cut small, they make a vow to cut a certain number of pieces of skin off of their, usually their hands or their arms. Depending on how many, it might extend further to their shoulders. But it could be for any number of reasons. Someone might sun dance because maybe they've joined the armed forces. And they want guidance and protection as they go into a war zone. It could be just for anything, of something that's important to them. Interesting. All of the native tribes were oral-based. Their traditions were oral-based, so it was passed down through story, but also by example. Children saw what was going on at the ceremonies. Not the Sundance in particular, but I've been to ceremonies, especially in the Southwest, where the children are sitting around emulating what they see the adults doing, where the adults might be beating on a drum. They'll have sticks and beating on the ground, and they pick up the rhythm. Sometimes in dances, children aren't allowed to participate in some dances, but you might see them off dancing off to the side somewhere. So part of it is imitation. Part of it is being taught. But most important is you have to have a spiritual leader, someone, a teacher who guides you through it. You don't just on your own decide you're going to do a sun dance or you're going to go on a vision quest. You ask somebody who has experience and knowledge to take you through it, so to speak. So there is a training that goes on. There's preparation, like for the sun dance, they would go through a sweat four times. I believe they go through the vision quest four times, depending on who you talk to. Not all Lakota do everything exactly the same. Not all Lakota are Lakota. Some are Dakota and some are Nakota. So, yes.
Would you say that there's a general sense that dance is something that could and should be used by non-Native Americans as a way to alleviate suffering, or is it kind of reserved for Native Americans because they have a special relationship with nature?
I would say that dances, Native American dances, should be used by Native Americans only unless invited. The big issue in Native American country or Indian country are those people who observe dances, or maybe they were invited one time and then they become so-called experts or what we call white shamans or plastic shamans, and they start selling their services. That's a big no-no. They don't do that. Dance is healing. We know that anyway. I mean, there are therapists who use dance to heal. So, yes, I think everybody can use dance. They just don't need to be using Native American dances. They need to find a dance from their own culture or what works for them. Or if many times Native people do invite non-Natives or Native peoples from other tribes into their ceremonies. But typically it's because they have a connection to the community and the expectation is that they will maintain that connection with the community, that they become part of it and support it. It's a very touchy subject for Native people.
Last one?
Sure.
Sort of like a reaction to a thought I'm having as I work through this material, religious responses to suffering, in my class and in the program. Religions explain suffering, give us explanations for suffering, and religions sometimes will give us many different explanations of suffering. Explanations of suffering come to an end somewhere, and a kind of bodily ritual brings a healing that no amount of rationalization can ever achieve.
Say that last part again.
Ritual participation, bodily participation in these rituals, brings a kind of healing with respect to suffering
okay.
that no amount of rationalization or explanation theology
right.
can bring.
Right.
I'm curious how you would react to that.
I would actually agree with it because I do think there's a way in which it's kind of a perennial question that humans ask each other. How can we treat each other this way? Why am I being treated this way? And there are no answers in the long run. I mean, we can give explanations. They're not really answers. And so it really is looking inside oneself and looking to those religious beliefs. And dance allows one to do that. So I do think it provides an answer in a way. An answer even when the suffering is ongoing. And that's why when I said when the dance ends that renewal is only temporary, because all those human relations start again and the suffering starts again. It never really ended. Yes. It depends on the tribe and it depends on the dance. Some tribes have societies for specific ceremonies, and so you have to be a member of that society within the tribe in order to be trained and to do that dance. Sometimes they're divided by genders. There are just male men's dances. There are just women's dances. The only exception would be someone, a man who behaves as a woman or a woman who behaves as a man that might dance in the other group. But typically it would be just men or women. So when you're talking about some people can dance better than others, let me use the powwow because those restrictions aren't there. They have what are called intertribals. And when the MC calls for an intertribal, he'll tell the audience, everybody come down, everybody dance. And sometimes he'll make jokes or whatever, but he'll say, it doesn't matter if you can dance. What's important is that you come out and you feel the earth beneath your feet, that you're touching the pulse of that earth, that you feel the pulse of the drum, that it's people coming together. Sometimes I hear Native students particularly, but sometimes older adults may be laughing at someone that obviously can't keep a beat, and I'm one of them they're laughing at. But other times I hear people telling their children, you don't laugh at someone who's dancing. They're doing something important here. Again, I think it depends on their experiences, who they're listening to, who their teachers were. Yeah, it just depends.
I was just curious how rigidly traditional the dances are. Are there any new developing dances or dances that developed to address contemporary issues?
Oh, to address contemporary issues. Like you're talking about, like in the last couple of decades, or I don't know that I could that I know of in the last couple of decades, but let's say in the last 100 years, definitely. Typically, as a professor, I label them under new religious movements. They become new ceremonies. The ghost dance was one of them. That's more than 100 years ago. The Bole Maru in California is another one of those. The prophet dances in California, those would be considered new. Again, those are all more than 100 years old. In a way, they're constantly becoming new because anyone can have a vision. And in those visions, they can receive new knowledge or new songs, new dances, new dance steps, rituals to go with those dances. And so they're constantly being reshaped in that way, which can sometimes, again, cause conflict because you'll have some Native people saying, no, this is the way we've always done it. And I don't know that that was such a problem 100 years ago, because 100 years ago more people recognized that Native people had visions. But now you have Native peoples like you might have among Christians who say, we don't have any more miracles today, or we don't have any more prophets today. That was back in the time of Jesus or something. You have Native peoples who say the same thing. Why should we believe that person had a vision? There's a lot more questioning, I think, today than we saw maybe 100 years ago. But if you look at the powwow dances, those in a way are new dances. They're based in traditional dances, But this evolved over time out of a need.
Do you think that if America started dancing, that might reverse the economic situation?
I wish I would get everybody dancing. It might make us act nicer towards each other anyway if we were dancing together. Yes. That's not something I study. I don't know a lot about it, but if I talk in terms of the Choctaw, which is my own tribe, we don't today dance at funerals, but historically we did. And one way to think of it is to help the dance the spirits across into the spirit world. It was also a way of helping people deal with their grief through dance, to let go of the person as they enter the spirit world.
I can only imagine that the Christian group of missionaries who opposed dancing of any kind saw their tradition, Indian tradition of dance, as immoral.
Oh, they saw their way of handling the deceased as immoral too, or as wrong, or as not making sense. And so some people placed the body on scaffolding. Some of them, like from the southeast, the bones were collected in a common house. In some places, say in California, they cremated them. The push was to have everybody inter the body. And so you see, if you look at funerals, at least with my tribe, you see an evolution where they went from interring, placing all the bones in this one house to at first having them in a sitting position, interred in a sitting position, and eventually, laying out they do in the modern world today. But yeah, you can see that impact even on funerals. Although I will say, at least among my tribe and the tribes in the southeast, that's where the missionaries had the most difficulty, and sometimes where they stepped back the most, because even if they got Native peoples, Choctaws, Cherokees, whatever, to come into the church camp and have a Christian funeral, the people would inevitably go back to their own camps and have a Native funeral too. And in fact, you will see this today still, more than one funeral taking place, a traditional funeral and a Christian funeral, or even a Native American church service. Now, that's a touchy area where our loved ones go and how we help them get there. Oh, yeah. They have two major powwows every summer. One is their Proclamation Day powwow. The other one is a more public powwow. Anybody can go to it. What they've often told me is they understand that other tribes have powwows that have a lot of spiritual significance to them and rules to them. They're adamant that for them it's strictly social. It's about bringing people together. About having developing friendships, whatever. They also have a lot of just local small ones inside, typically in their, I think it's where the Senior Citizen Center is. They'll have powwows, different people sponsoring them throughout the year. So yeah, they do have powwows. They still have traditional ceremonies. I've never been to one. I've never seen one. They're very protective of them. They don't want outsiders at them. That's not to say outsiders have not been to them. I'm just not one of them, okay? So I can't really tell you anything about them. I haven't studied them or anything. Okay?
Well, that was really interesting and really thought-provoking. Join me in a second. Thank you.
week before Thanksgiving on Abd el-Kadar, a 19th century Algerian Muslim who led resistance against French occupation. And after moved the town of El Pader, Iowa, is named, the only town in America.
Oh, wow.
Named after Muslims in Iowa, northeast Iowa. Wow. So come and find out more.
I'll have to come. Cool.
Yeah.
It's got an
education project that we have there now that sponsors an essay running.
Oh, really?
High school students and college students, too. I believe someone from Iowa won.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Really?
Your majors, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed it. It made me think differently about how I do my work. Like I said, I never even thought in terms of a response to suffering.
That was so amazing and interesting.
Thank you
so much for doing that.
Oh, you're welcome.
I totally respect the comparison project.
Oh, great.
Amazing.
Good.
You're fine. I love dancing.
Oh,
so
okay. Cool.
I've done all these different forms, and just the whole ceremony is very interesting. And
oh, good. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Now, are you a student here?
No, I work for the Department of Natural Resources, and I own a dance studio.
Oh,
in East Village,
okay.
So I
okay.
do like belly dance, like Middle Eastern stuff.
Okay.
Salsa,
okay.
A lot of Latin.
All right. Cool.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm so excited.
I was gonna say you'll have to go to a powwow sometime if you haven't gone to one.
I know a Navajo dancer in Arizona, and
he's
shown me his whole so epic, all the eagle feathers and everything and the beads, and it's really amazing. I mean, yeah.
Well, you know, the University of Iowa holds a powwow every April.
I haven't been to one yet, but
come on down.
I'll have to go. The ghost dance sounded really interesting.
It's
so intuitive. That's what people don't get. It's like complete intuitive. You don't write it down. It comes.
Yeah, exactly, through visions and stuff. Yeah.
Genius.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyways, I'm tired. Thank
you. You're welcome.
Thank you much.
Thank you.
Right, I'm going to head out, but thanks
for
everything.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed the conversation with you.
Nice.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, and you're driving back?
Yeah.
I'm fine.
My only concern is getting me back to the highway.
Oh, it's not hard.
Yeah.
I thought it was going to be hard to find 3rd Street, and I never found it.
Do you want to follow me?
Sure. Are you headed out that way?
Yeah, actually, I'll be going right by the interstate on ramp.
Oh, okay.
You want 235.
235 to 80, going
okay.
south, east.
I can, yeah.
Okay.
28th has a... No, 28th doesn't. No, 31st does.
And MLK might be confusing, so I was going to send her down 31st.
Okay, yeah, if you want to just drive behind me. Where did you park?
She's parked just south of the intersection of 27th and Forest on 27th. So she's got to go up the Forest and hang a left. And go down to 31st and hang a left.
Oh, yeah, that's not difficult.
She's right, outside where we park for our building, just a little further up toward Forest.
Oh, okay. Oh, she's on 27th. She's on 27th.
Oh, I better take this off. I better remember.
I
be talking to everybody as I go out.
I turned the volume down.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're parked on the same road, so it's up to you.
Okay.
That would be great.
Have
you followed me? It's on my way home.
It would just make life easier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure. I have a quick question.
Sure.
I have a friend that has recently put together a book about young Native Americans.
Uh-huh.
And he just contacted me a couple weeks ago and asked if I knew of some elders that he could get in contact with. And so I was wondering if I could give him your an email address or something.
You can.
Maybe get some ideas from you.
Okay. He's writing children's books?
It's for young adults. The last one he wrote was, I think, young Native American stories. And then now he's writing one about elders.
Okay. Because I would actually refer him to this professor at the University of Illinois Urbana. She has a whole website. She's amazing. She constantly keeps it updated. It's all on children's work for books, projects, all kinds of things for children. I assume young adults fit in that category
for
her.
Yeah.
But,
could you just write down your email, your name and email, and then I'll just give that to him?
We went out to Pine Ridge a couple summers ago and did some service work out there.
Oh, you did?
And so we've been sort of interested in the Native story since then. So.
Oh, okay. Were you building houses?
Really
different things.
Porta potty.
Oh, porta potty.
Bunk beds.
Yeah. Yeah.
Might do it again this year, maybe.
Yeah.
That is, you know,
it's
not the poorest county anymore, but it used to be the poorest county for years and years.
They said, I think it's because the other Native reservations in South Dakota decreased. It's not that they increased in, like, poverty level, but the others decreased
in poverty.
Do you know what I mean? So
yes,
it's not like they got any better. It's just the others
got worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they need all the help they can get, that's for sure. Yeah.
And you're Choctaw.
Uh-huh.
So do you go back home and participate in some of the rituals? Like,
we're one of those that lost most of our ceremonies. Most Choctaws are Christians today.
Okay.
We do have an annual festival around Labor Day.
Right.
Where people do demonstration dances of the old dances, but they're not actually doing ceremonies.
Sure.
Now, there is one guy who started a stomp ground called Yellow Hill. I've never been there.
In Oklahoma?
Yes, mm-hmm. For Choctaws.
Mm-hmm.
But he also helped the Chickasaw start their grounds, too, and I have gone to theirs. I mostly go to Creek and Cherokee stomp dances, not my own tribes.
Okay.
Because there really isn't. There may be at Yellow Hill, but I've never been there.
Okay.
But I grew up in Muskogee, which is between Cherokee and Creek country, and Choctaw's actually about 45 minutes south.
Okay.
And so I just grew up in Cherokee and Creek
more.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, thanks for
coming.
You're welcome.